Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and the art of healing. If you think our healthcare system is the best in the world, listen to these statistics. The healthcare system in the United States in 2002 ranked 29th among the countries of the world. That was between Slovenia and Portugal. Our life expectancy is almost 5 years shorter than several other countries, including Iceland, Italy, and Sweden. And for infants, it's even worse. In the year 2000 in the U.S., there were 6.9, almost 7, infant deaths per 1,000, compared to 3.2 in Japan, 3.4 in Sweden, 3.4 in France, and on it goes from there. And other countries spend far less than we do. The United States spends $1.7 trillion on healthcare. I said trillion. Much of my consulting is with medical victims, people for whom the system has failed severely. That said, as I read the book written by today's guests, I never stopped shaking my head in disbelief. Join me in the next hour in conversation with Donald Bartlett and James Steele as we discuss their latest book, Critical Condition: How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine. Donald L. Bartlett and James B. Steele are America's most widely acclaimed investigative journalistic team. They've worked together for 3 decades, first at the Philadelphia Inquirer and since 1997 as editors-at-large for Time. They are the only journalists in history to have won 2 Pulitzer Prizes and 2 national magazine awards, as well as dozens of other national awards. They are the co-authors of 6 books, including America, What Went Wrong, which spent 8 months on the New York bestsellers list, and, of course, today's newest book, Critical Condition, which we're going to discuss today on the air. Welcome to you both. I'm really thrilled to have you on the air.
Nice to be with you, Lena.
Now, I don't know your both of your voices. I believe I've got both of you there. So what you might do is, as you answer a question, if you jump in, you might just say, this is Donald or this is James, so people can tell who you are.
That's great, Lena. This is Jim, by the way.
Jim Steele, welcome to you. When I was little, my family had a doctor and a friend who made house visits. This was back in the old days, before Wall Street got interested in the business of medicine. Your book is an indictment of this partnership. Do you want to talk a little bit about what was the first on this long list of losses that we've got as a result of this collaboration?
Well, one of the things that that you see happening in the collaboration, while there have been little bits of it around for some period of time, and by the way, this is Jim speaking, Lena, just so your listeners know, while there have been bits of this around for a period of time, it really accelerated this move into for-profit market-driven medicine back in the early 80s. At the time, healthcare costs were going up, and Washington began to wring its hands and say, we've got to do something about this. And at the time, everybody was in love with the idea of business efficiencies, that this would produce savings, would extend care to more and more people, and so forth. So Washington very actively began to withdraw federal funds from a number of not-for-profit HMOs, and to encourage Wall Street to actively get involved in this, to take HMOs public, to convert them to stockholding operations, and they also encourage more and more hospitals to be bought by private interests and publicly held companies. The idea being that these efficiencies would somehow bring benefits of the American healthcare system to more people and hold down costs. And one of the great casualties of this thing, I mean, there have been many, and you see this all across the spectrum, is for one thing, fewer and fewer people have health insurance. We got more and more uninsured in this country. Many of those who have health insurance are underinsured, but very often don't know that until some significant illness or accident befalls them. realize just how insufficient the coverage they have happens to be. One of the real fallouts from this, and you really see this big time in California, has been the whole for-profit hospital movement. Tenet, of course, has been such a big player out in California. And many parts of the state where hospitals which were once not-for-profit or at least non-profit, where Tenet has bought these, there's been outcomes in terms of staffing ratios by the nurses. There have been questions of cleanliness in many facilities. It's not just Tenet, by the way. This has been
excuse me for interrupting you, but I don't think people are familiar with that name. Even though we're in California, I don't think that anybody knows who it is that's purchased all the hospitals. They hear things like Sutter Health, or they know Kaiser. There are certain names associated with large groupings of hospitals or particular kinds of healthcare programs they can buy, but I don't think anyone's heard that name, and I hadn't heard it either.
Well, Tenet is one of the second largest publicly held hospital chain in America. There's a large one called HCA, Hospital Corporation of America, based in Tennessee, which also owns some facilities there in California. But the two of them own an incredible number of hospitals around the country. And the principal goal of a for-profit hospital chain is obviously to make a good return for stockholders. And what you've seen in many aspects of the for-profit hospitals is there's been a decline in the number of beds. Some have complained about certainly availability of supplies. There have been a whole range of those things that have impacted patient health and patient care. So, and many of these companies, we have to stand back for a second to just tell you, we were astonished. There are names of companies owning hospitals that we had never heard of, that the average person's never heard of. Because once Wall Street was invited into this, I mean, once the private market was invited into this, a lot of people began buying HMOs, hospitals, various aspects of the whole field. So that model has governed us. And the point which I didn't stress a minute ago was that when the whole market-driven experiment began to really take hold in the early 80s, the reason supposedly was to control costs. Well, at the time, healthcare as a percentage of our national wealth was around 10.5% of our gross domestic product. Today, it's roughly 15.5%, heading towards 16%, with no end in sight. So 2 decades after we've embraced this model, costs are higher than ever. More and more people do not have insurance. More yet have insufficient coverage. So the point we lay out in the book is that the whole for-profit market-driven concept has failed miserably.
Well, one of the things I would bring up here is that in the beginning of your book, you say that the market-based economy is okay for certain things, the free market economy, but not for healthcare. And I would posit that what we're seeing in the healthcare industry is the same kind of degradation of service that we're seeing across the board in the United States right now. I mean, the same sorts of problems of outsourcing things like these phone banks. When you call an advice nurse now for your insurance company, you're talking to somebody in India probably sometimes, or certainly not a nurse, and maybe never will be able to talk. So but this kind of change in the shift toward running everything as if it's a factory to save money.
You're absolutely right.
That's changing everything. It's making everything bad. It's making it very difficult for anybody to make a living even, and for people who work in this industry too.
And that's an excellent point. And because you're right, all the things that we call up call centers for, if it's a mistake on our credit card bill or some piece of merchandise we've ordered that hasn't been delivered, I mean, we go through that particular process and we never know who we're speaking to. But it's one thing if we're bothered by a line item on our credit card bill. It's quite another thing if the person on the other end of the line is perhaps in India speaking with a perfect American accent, which is what happens now, looking at medical records of folks in this country. And it's part of the impersonal nature of this, where everybody's gone through this process of trying to cut costs and so forth. And they have truly turned so much of healthcare into an, almost a manufacturing process. Many of the call centers that exist in many parts of the country literally are modern-day factories where the folks are just there minute in, minute out, fielding calls. The first line that when you call them is not getting a nurse in most cases. It's simply you're getting a clerk who is not particularly very well trained in some cases.
And makes more money if they get off the phone faster.
Exactly.
Yes.
And who is in fact timed and clocked by a computer to make sure that they don't spend too much time on the phone with somebody. And in fact, we had stories from folks in these call centers who talk about how they're basically harassed if they spend too much time with a patient. But the difference here, and this is what I think you're stressing, which we tried to stress in the book, is that it's one thing to do this if it's your credit card bill. This is another thing if it's somebody's health, where the problem may be very complicated, may be very sophisticated, may really require somebody who really knows something about medicine and health and cannot be easily disposed of. So health is, we make the point in the book that it's one thing to have the market selling cars and apparel and cereals and all of those other consumer items, but it's quite another thing to think that that market will function when it comes to healthcare, and it really doesn't.
I would say that it doesn't function in anything because
people
in this country are increasingly not able to afford any of the things. I mean, you might work if you're lucky enough to still have a job in the audio industry, you're likely not to be able to make enough money to buy the car that you're working on.
Your point is very well taken. Wouldn't argue with that in the least.
You know, one of the things that's particularly staggering or impressive about the book is that you get the feeling that the United States is still the Wild West. I mean, the stories of these particular characters that you describe, the sort of lead characters in this movement, are very scurrilous and they're scoundrels. I mean, they're real scoundrels, and they get dragged into court, and they get sued, and their businesses go under, and they somehow manage still to have made millions and billions of dollars and to get off and go on and do this again. So part of what's happening is that the usual way that things are the oversight of this sort of stuff is gone because of the sort of cronyism that exists, this sort of collusion between big pharma, doctors, academia, and the culture, the political culture, is actually enabling the fraud to go on because everybody's getting their pockets lined. But as I said, knowing what I know, I still spent the entire time I was reading this book just shaking my head slowly back and forth in disbelief. It's so dreadful. Let's get into a little bit of some of the specifics. One of the things we said a little minute ago is that people often become sort of complacent about their health care insurance. A lot of people are at Kaiser here in California, and they're fine. Yes. They say it's fine. But my experience is that when people get into trouble, it's not fine. And an example would be, maybe you want to describe exactly what it's like from the perspective of somebody who's riding in an ambulance, why it's not, you know, this closing of hospitals, this cutting back on resources. You're in a you're in an ambulance on your way to the ER, and what happens?
Well, it's interesting that you talk about reading the book and shaking your head as much as you know about the issue. Don and I went through really the same thing in all the years we did the research on this book. We knew a number of things about healthcare. We knew a number of things that were wrong with the field, but we were continually coming across stories and broad trends in the field that had us doing the same thing. And the one you just mentioned is typical of that. It's called ambulance diversions. We're not even really aware of this. What happens is when an emergency room in a hospital has every bed taken and somebody needs to get to an ER, if that hospital is filled, then they are diverted to the next closest hospital, which is usually not the one closest to the patient who needs it, because it may be closer to their home. But ER diversions are going on all across the country, basically every week. I mean, somewhere every day in America this happens. And it's a product of a couple of things. One is we've lost a huge number of hospital rooms in this country. So 1980 to 2001, when our population grew by more than 25%. We lost 24% of our hospital beds in this country. And a lot of that had to do with the for-profit model of companies just shutting down various wards. Now, what that's done is it's put more pressure on emergency rooms to receive people. And the second thing that's happened, because practicing medicine in many places is so uncomfortable and so difficult for so many doctors, a lot of them are referring patients, even insured patients, to emergency rooms. So all of these have overloaded emergency rooms throughout the country, put huge strains on them. They're being used for things that they were never used to be used for. And as a result of that, when somebody really needs to get into one, he may be riding around in an ambulance until you can find one that will take you. And that's not what ERs were designed for.
Well, in addition, you're saying that a lot of times people can't be moved from an ER bed to a bed in the hospital because there's no room, so they can't go to the ICU, so they're stuck in the ER, and that fills beds. There are poor people. Well, there's this fantasy about poor people being in the ER, but in fact, there are people who have health insurance who can't get appointments with their doctors, so they're in the ER.
Well, these are the newest members of the ER contingent, people with health insurance, but the let's back up a minute, because you talked originally about your family doctor who made house calls, and one of the reasons this person doesn't exist anymore is this market-driven system, which basically has driven out of the business most sole family practitioners. They can't function. The overhead cost of trying to comply with multiple insurance programs is just too stiff. And as a result, wages of individual family doctors have just fallen through the floor. Most people don't quite understand this. They still think of doctors as being well paid, and many are. But the old family doctor just economically can't make it anymore. I can't tell you the number of calls we've had from family doctors since the book came out, who said, you know, this is the reason I got out of the business.
Well, you might want to explain. This is Jim Steele. Don Bartlett. The insurance and CPT codes, how the companies actually short doctors on their bills.
Well, that's another part of this, and there is no way that a sole practitioner can keep track of the insurer's reimbursement fees for people they've seen weeks or months before, and the insurers routinely reduce the amount of the payments to the doctors. Often they hope the doctors won't notice it. Sometimes they do, and they'll complain, and they'll drag out protests, but there is no sole practitioner can function under that system. That's why the group practices grew up to replace them. There have to be people in the office, as many as, you know, a fourth to a third of the office staff is devoted to processing insurance claims. That's what makes the system so crazy. Instead of delivering health care, we're delivering insurance paperwork. It makes no sense at all.
Which, in addition, gets lost. I mean, one of the really frightening things about some of these stories about these big business hospitals and big business insurance companies and these really scoundrels who you name and describe and talk about what happens to their businesses, who get on board and sort of interface with insurance companies and teach them and run these sort of scams on hospitals and insurance companies, are creating a situation where the paperwork, you know, like a certain hospital will go out of business and all of the records for the patients are gone.
Well, that's true. We ran across one in Southern California where the entire sort of provider network collapsed for a variety of reasons. It was somebody trying to make it profitable, and for various reasons it really couldn't be so. But we had stories of, and these are told in the book. I mean, one is of a woman who shows up to see a neurologist in a clinic in Orange County, which she had gone to for a number of years. She had a very mysterious ailment that was troubling her. It looked like incipient MS, perhaps. And she shows up to the clinic one morning for this very important appointment, and basically there's a closed sign on it, like it's a five and dime store that's suddenly gone out of business. But it's sort of typical of this chaos, and inside were her medical records and those of hundreds of them. And it turned out, all over Southern California that day, scores of clinics that were affiliated with this provider, every one of them had closed their doors. the records then sort of vanished into a big warehouse where literally hundreds of thousands of people never got all their medical records. Some people were able to get some of them, but because of the chaos that ensued with this entire collapse, many people didn't get things. So x-rays, laboratory tests, somebody's medical history going back a couple of decades, all of those things simply just disappeared into the chaos of the thing. And people may say, well, gee, that's hard to imagine that such a thing could happen. But what people don't realize, what's going on in healthcare in this country, there are bankruptcies of doctors' practices around the U.S., various places, time to time. Another fallout from Wall Street's experiment into trying to provide healthcare. Others are going through consolidations where patients sort of get lost in the mix. The amount of turmoil in the field is something, frankly, while we were generally aware of it, absolutely stunned us the deeper we looked at it.
There's one thing that you don't cover in the book that I know about because of people I've interviewed, which is that the oversight that should be paying attention to the... There's one of the things that you talk about is the number of deaths from medical errors is just staggering. I mean, it's just, you know, you talk about the fact that in 1950, there were 194 deaths from cancer for every 100,000 people. And now we have this war on cancer. So now in 2000, that number was 196 out of 100,000. So we've had two more deaths from cancer per 100,000 people in the last 50 years with this enormous expenditure. You know, there's this huge cancer establishment not working. And what's even worse is that the number of people who are dying from medical errors is staggering. I mean, prescription drug deaths. I think this is a yearly figure, 225,000 to 257,000. So there's the oversight, which is should be dragging these, you know, busting these people, is instead going after doctors who are using vitamins in their practice. Incidentally, just quickly ID the show. This is Lena Berman, Your Own Health and Fitness, on the phone with Donald Bartlett and James Steele, authors of Critical Condition.
Lena, this is a really important point on the oversight. There isn't any. There is, and this is probably one of the really two or three more shocking aspects of U.S. healthcare, which is supposed to be world class. There is no independent monitoring of healthcare in this country. As a result, you know, as the statistics now stand, it's the third leading cause of death.
Oh, boy.
After cancer and heart disease. We think that if you had an independent examination of this issue, it would be the leading cause of death. And there are a couple of reasons for this. One is what the medical community classes as a mistake. For example, you can go into hospitals around the country and there are people dying every day from staph infections.
Because the places are dirty now.
Right.
Thank you. The places are dirty. But the medical world does not count staph infection as a mistake. Well, I got to tell you, if I take my car into the garage to have a lube and oil change and someone leaves some of the lug nuts off and I crash in the highway, that's a mistake by the garage. It's not my mistake. And yet, if you go into the hospital and develop a staph infection and die, that's not a mistake. Well, that needs to be reclassified as a mistake. And there are there are other areas similar to that. And then the drug interactions are not tracked at all. Whatever reporting is voluntary. Sometimes they pick it up, as they have with the Vioxx, but more often than not, they do not until it's too late.
Well, and there are many stories in your book of nurses giving people the wrong amounts of a pharmaceutical and killing them.
Well, you know, this is probably the best reason of all to understand why death by mistake are not even close to being the real number. This is a case in where you have this nurse and worked in hospitals
And there's a shortage of nurses, too.
Yeah,
so.
In across eastern Pennsylvania and New Jersey, and by his own count, killed more than 40 people by administering lethal doses of mostly heart medications. But all of those people, all those death certificates, they just list the routine cause of death as whatever they were in the hospital for.
Or a drug interaction.
But they do not classify them. They fail to detect murders. So if a hospital in the health care community cannot pick up on a murder, how in heaven's name do you expect it to identify drug deaths by drug interactions? That's not going to happen.
There's also this issue of they go to do a procedure on a patient, and all of a sudden they go to the supply closet, and it's not there. The thing they need to do, and they send the patient home without doing the procedure. And then there's the stories of the false positives, where people are treated with chemotherapy or have both of their breasts lopped off, and then later they say, we're really sorry, you didn't have cancer. This happens a lot. You read about it in the papers. I mean, and there are suits. I mean, people are taken to court, but nothing seems to happen.
No, the system itself is not adjusted to correct it. It never is. To be sure, there are hospitals out there across the country that do look at these things and they say, okay, we're not going to make sure this doesn't happen in our place. How long that goes on, really nobody knows because nobody goes back and looks. But the fact of the matter is that these mistakes are recurring all the time, year after year after year. And there are no system changes put in place to correct them. One of the simplest changes that could be made is a uniform computer system that would allow all entities in the healthcare field to communicate with each other. Ain't going to happen under the existing for-profit system. Not going to happen at all.
Let's talk about who gets to decide how long you stay in the hospital.
You like that part.
I do, yes. I'll tell you one thing. I've never felt that hospital, you know, it's like for me, it's like give me a morphine drip before you take me to the hospital.
Right.
Cancer screening for me. If you find a cancer for some reason because it's coming out my ears, just get me a morphine drip. Don't take me to the hospital. It's too scary.
Well, after you hear this story, everybody may want a morphine drip.
Yeah.
But, again, this is one of the eye-openers that we had. This is Jim Steele again. And
I think people can tell the difference between your voices.
Okay.
Now.
One of the things that was a real eye-opener to us is that, I mean, most people think that it's their doctor who decides how long they're going to stay in the hospital. And in a number of cases, it is. But increasingly, the decision is made not by the doctor, but by the insurer, by the whoever is providing the health coverage for the patient. And what do they turn to decide how long you stay in the hospital? It turns out there's a very sophisticated series of guidelines that have been developed by a company based in Seattle that essentially was into pension actuarial tables for most of its history that has gotten into the healthcare field in a big way in the last 10 to 15 years, where they've developed guidelines that say what the optimum situation should be for a patient who has this particular problem. If it's a child with one particular serious childhood disease, should they stay in the hospital 2 days or 10 days? Anyway, all of this is codified in this very extensive series of guidelines by a company called Milliman. We were never even aware of this company, but hospitals everywhere know about them because we ran across some cases where the insurers turned to those guidelines and basically over the objections of doctors compelled a patient to be discharged. One case we tell the story of in the book was of a woman who was pregnant in New York, and her doctor felt she had been discharged prematurely. It turned out she was back in the hospital about a week or 10 days after she was prematurely discharged with a far more serious problem. She and her unborn child, their lives were in danger for a period of time based on that premature discharge. So this is what's going on in healthcare around the world. It's not your doctor in many cases who's able to make the decisions. It's the insurers or a set of guidelines that the average person has no knowledge of that folks are turning to as kind of the Bible to decide how long people stay. Many doctors call these guidelines cookbook medicine. It's like there's this set of instructions on how long you should stay in the hospital if you have this, that, or the other ailment or disease. When in fact, you talk to any doctor, any nurse out there, and they will say, yes, while this particular condition may mean you're in the hospital this long or that long, every individual is different.
Yeah.
And every doctor
yes.
evaluates that patient based on what they see before them, not based on some idealized notion of how quickly you can discharge people. So this is what's got doctors so upset around the country, that so many of the decisions that they historically have made have been taken away from them, and the result has not been good for patient care.
And also the doctors themselves have been affected. One of the stories that didn't even make the cutoff list for the book was a child neurologist who wanted to put his patient in the hospital to it was having epileptic seizures and wanted to determine the frequency and severity of the seizures. So he put the child in the hospital for a week, and during the course of the week, the child had one extensive seizure. Mm. Well, when it came time to pay the bill, the insurer said, we will pay for one day, the day the child had the seizure. And, of course, the doctor said, well, wait a minute, how do I know what day it's going to be? And he said, well, that's your problem, not our problem.
Oh, boy.
And that's the way medicine is practiced under this, you know, the world's greatest healthcare system.
We need to take a brief musical break. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with authors of Critical Condition, How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine, Don Bartlett and Jim Steele. Their book is on the shelves as we speak. We're going to take a brief musical break. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
I've got 90,000 pounds in my pajamas. I've got 40,000 French francs in my fridge. I've got lots of lovely lira. Now the Deutsche Mark's getting dearer, and my dollar bills would buy the Brooklyn Bridge. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money you can make a splash. Quite as wonderful as money.
Money, money, money.
There is nothing like a newly minted pound.
Money, 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 money.
Everyone must hanker for the butchness of a banker. It's accountancy that wakes the world around.
Round.
You can keep your Marxist ways, but it's only just a phase. For it's money, money, money makes the world go round.
Money, 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 money,
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I hear my guests, Don Bartlett and Jim Steele, giggling in the background. That was Monty Python, of course, from Monty Python Sings, doing the money song, which I thought was just uniquely appropriate for the show. We are talking about my guest's newest book, Critical Condition, How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine. If you missed parts of today's show and want to get a copy of this or any other in this series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772, or you can go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.com, where you can also find information on subscribing to the newsletter Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine, which very much follows on the heels of this alarming situation we find ourselves in. Before I move on to the issue of pharmaceuticals, you're pretty equitable in terms of going after all of the large insurance companies and HMOs by name. I'm wondering if you found any that were less offensive.
You can see how we're both rushing.
We decided to not go into the perilous realm of trying to rank them. Obviously, there are differences, and there are differences in certainly in parts of the country, even within some of the big companies. And sometimes the difference is who you may get on the other end of the line when you call the call center. Sometimes it's a good response, sometimes it isn't. I think one of the things that struck us about this, though, and that is, and this is in some ways the most disturbing thing, is that in addition to some of the problems you see with kind of the for-profit, publicly held insurers and so forth, I mean the Aetnas, the Humanas, and the United Healthcare and so forth, a lot of the not-for-profit entities, which used to be immune from some of this, have been caught up in a lot of these efficiency ideas as well, as though if they do not behave in the same way and pile up large reserves of cash and so forth, that they somehow are going to be vulnerable to takeover or what have you. So it's not while the market-based thing is what's been driving this, this kind of disease is spread to throughout the system anymore, and you just see almost every entity we shouldn't say everyone, but increasingly even the not-for-profit entities are caught up with it in this
You mentioned people there in California, Northern California in particular, often speak of good experiences with Kaiser, and I think that's probably...
Yeah, not the people who come to me, I have to tell you. No, I'm serious. No, I mean, I'm actually thinking about doing a show with a client of mine who talked to her lawyer, who's in the process of suing Kaiser, and her story was breathtaking when she came in and told it to me.
Well, this is the problem when you look at some of these, and these are systemic problems. When Kaiser started out, when old Henry J. Kaiser set up the system, he had one goal. He wanted to keep his workforce healthy, and his goal wasn't to make a lot of money. But that thing has been turned upside down. But we tell the story of just one Kaiser patient, Margaret Utterback, who was she'd been a Kaiser patient for 50 years. She wakes up with a severe pain, calls the clinic, and phone rings and rings and rings forever. Nobody answers. 8 o'clock in the morning, calls her daughter to come over to see her because the pain is increasing. Puts in another call, 9:45, and she finally gets a human error. She goes through a series of these calls in which she's told there are no appointments available today. You can't see anybody. She's put on hold. The calls are transferred. They're forwarded, and she's left hanging out there. And finally, she's told at one point to call back after 3 o'clock for an appointment. Meanwhile, the pain's getting worse and worse and worse. And finally, she does get somebody who says, look, come in. And someone will see you in a few hours, late in the afternoon, about a little after 4 o'clock. Well, the pain increases, and finally she and her daughter head off for the clinic, and sure enough, the doctor sees her. It makes an immediate diagnosis. This isn't a doctor's fault. This is a systemic fault that she has an abdominal aortic aneurysm. But it's already ruptured. And so, by the time she's in surgery, she's just, blood is just flowing out and enormous transfusions. But the short end of the story is that she's dead. She dies as a result of a system that simply does not work. It cannot separate out people who are in a critical state and people who are calling because they want to talk about their bills.
Well, this is ironic, of course, but I wouldn't have a career if it weren't for this mess, because what I'm doing is something that the medical profession should be doing, which is educating people about how all this stuff works, not about how the healthcare works, but about how their body works. Just how do you take care of yourself, and how do you watch out for stuff, and what sorts of tests do you want to be doing, and what do you watch out for, and how do you make sense of studies that you're reading, and how do you understand why some studies are being reported and some are not, and how do you look at a study and understand what it's saying, because you can ask a question any number of ways and get any answer that you want, which is how the pharmaceutical company works. But one thing before we move on, I just did a show last week with Dr. Marcia Angel, so we went in depth in on her book, The Truth About the Drug Companies, which is another book that makes you gasp. I wonder if you want to give any stories about some of these characters that you describe who have made billions of dollars in the industry, who have just been shysters and con men and have just run systems into the ground. Do you want to talk about any of it? Because you have very many stories about these cowboys in your book. Do you have a favorite one?
We have, there are any number of folks in the book that, and again, it's always hard to pick those you like the best in terms of, unfortunately, illustrating what's going on out there. But one profile that we do sketch out is of an investment banker in New York, who originally was with Smith Barney, then moved on to another investment banking firm, and who picked up on the next latest thing in healthcare from rehabilitation facilities like HealthSouth, which was the great scandal in recent years, to backing hospital companies, to doctors, corporations made up of doctors, a guy by the name of Benjamin Lorello, and a very colorful character who sort of single-handedly saw the great opportunities that were going to be available in healthcare when Washington and others began to see that this was an emerging new field, and in fact he was quoted at one point as talking about how healthcare was kind of the brave new world out there for Wall Street, because there were going to be so many of these opportunities. So he's an example of one. I mean, there are others, even doctor entrepreneurs in Southern California who tried to put together various combines, which then went bankrupt, causing huge chaos throughout the system. One of our favorites is getting back to the Tenet hospital chain that we talked about at the earlier, which is probably the single largest for-profit hospital chain in California. This was born in the early 90s out of the ruins of another hospital chain by a totally different name. And when it collapsed, the board of directors decided to bring in somebody new to run this hospital company. So who did they turn to? A doctor? Somebody had the slightest idea of healthcare? No, they turned to an investment banker in Hollywood whose entire history had been doing deals in the entertainment business, a fellow named Jeffrey Barbaco. And he took over the Tenet Hospital operation. And the Tenet story is really pivotal to what's really happened in this field, because after he took it over, it was based in Los Angeles, and it turned out he lived in Santa Barbara, which is about 90 miles up the Pacific, northwest of L.A., and he decided that he wanted to move the corporate headquarters to Santa Barbara. And if anybody's ever seen Santa Barbara knows what a lovely, beautiful town it is. It's not particularly ideal for a nationally based corporation because they don't have a very big airport and so forth. But that's where he moved it. And so how did he solve the problem of getting to Tenet's hospitals all over California and throughout the United States? Well, they bought some airplanes that then became the way that they serviced their various properties. To us, it was just an illustration of the kind of excess that you saw arising in many parts of the healthcare field that were driven by this for-profit model that had nothing to do with patient care and, in fact, drained off money away from that. Barbaco, after a number of years of running Tenet, was essentially resigned from the board under fire because of the poor performance of the company and some scandals that arose in Northern California on basically a cardiac factory where doctors up there were just performing cardiac procedures and operations on people, some of whom had healthy hearts, believe it or not, did not need the procedure. So it's, you know, the book is just loaded with these examples of where this philosophy has led us down the wrong road, and it at the same time has opened up all kinds of opportunity for guys to make a lot of money who had absolutely no experience in the field of healthcare and so forth. And who's paid the price? Patients throughout the country. Our costs have gone up in the U.S. And
people are dying. People are dying.
And people are dying.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the consequences are just staggering in that sense.
One of the things that might be helpful to talk about a little bit is to remind patients that or listeners that because they have insurance doesn't mean the insurance will actually pay for stuff.
That's absolutely true.
So how do you protect yourself in that situation?
Well, this is why, and I suppose before we leave today, we'll talk a little bit about our.
Oh yeah.
Proposal for all this,
yes.
But this is why we say under the current system, you really don't know until you come into a very severe situation exactly what you have. I mean, we tell the story of a teacher in New Jersey who thought she had a blue ribbon plan that covered her, but she ended up with a major medical emergency. She was hospitalized for a long period of time. And she was in danger of losing that if it had not been for some creative efforts by some of her coworkers who were able to donate some sick days to her and so forth that kept her covered under things.
So one of the ways that they play games is that there's issues about how you manage to stay covered, like if you're out of work because you're sick.
This is one of the catch-22s of the situation. Like, a lot of people have great coverage, but if you were out of work for a long period of time, maybe you've exhausted your sick leave, you're then not on the payroll of your employer, and therefore you don't have health coverage. you know, that's one of those catch-22 situations that's out there that nobody ever thinks about. But if you're in a catastrophic situation, that can happen to you. And we tell a number of those stories in the book.
The other thing that people really need, if they get involved in the healthcare industry in any big way, is they need an advocate. They need someone at their side, both in terms of overseeing their medical treatment, but the billing in particular.
I agree.
It is a full-time accounting job. The woman that Jim just referred to, her husband basically became a full-time healthcare accountant to make sure that the insurers paid what they were legally obligated to pay. This goes on all the time, and it's one of the really disturbing parts of this business. Insurers routinely deny payment for things they are legally obligated to pay because they know that a given number of people ultimately will pick up the bill themselves, or at least try to. And it's just plain fraud. They will say, well, these are just mistakes. But there is no way for an industry to make this many mistakes over and over again, year after year after year. It's really part of a deliberate plan to overbill, overcharge, and secure payments to which they're not entitled. But unless you have someone going through every bill, unless you may have someone assessing those charges and making sure that the insurers pay them, you're out of luck, because before you know it, there's a lien on your house.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Don Bartlett, who you just heard speaking, and James Steele. Their book is Critical Condition, about the healthcare industry. Moving on to pharmaceuticals very briefly, since last week I did cover this in depth with Marcia Angel, who wrote The Truth About the Drug Companies. In 2001, doctors prescribed 146 drugs for every 100 office visits. I also have a chart that Dr. Fawcett, my partner in the Progressive Health Observer, and who also works on the show with me, gave me. It's from the National Center of Health Statistics. It's an annual report this year. Not surprisingly, the percentage of people over 65 who are taking, you know, lots of medications, more than one medication, is very high. It's almost 100%. It's 89% or something like that. What's shocking here is if you look at the percentage increase, just the increase of people taking more drugs, the highest increase is in young people. There's an increase of 53.7% of people taking three or more prescription drugs among 18 to 44 years in the male. And then in women, under 18 years old, there is a percentage increase of people taking three or more prescription drugs of 87% increase. So I have to think these are for skin things, birth control pills, antidepressants. It's just, do we need all this treatment?
Well, I think you put your finger on it. Part of the problem is, we can blame the healthcare system for much of what's wrong, but people themselves also have to take some responsibility. The idea is so common now of a parent running to a doctor's office demanding an antibiotic for a condition for which an antibiotic isn't appropriate, and a doctor prescribing it because he doesn't want to bother, he doesn't want the hassle from an outraged parent. And, you know, people themselves have got to bear some of the responsibility.
I have to tell you that people constantly tell me that their doctors pressure them into taking antidepressants, taking birth control pills, taking things that are blocking their hormones like Lupron or something like that. I mean, there's very much pressure put on the patient as well.
Well, I think that's probably, especially when you're talking about antidepressants and whatever this the hyperactivity, all of these disorders, which really have grown up in the last decade or so, and they've been given fancy names for which the medicines can be prescribed.
Well, and there's this terrible term. Forgive me again for speaking over you, but there's this terrible term, standard of care, which often means that if somebody has an appendicitis, they're automatically going to get an operation, even though an antibiotic might work. There's a way in which standard of care dictates a very invasive and expensive treatments.
Well, there's no doubt that the way our system is, works, and we deal with this toward the end of the book. We and play examples along the way. We're geared so much toward procedures, and we make this point over and over again that that's where so much of the money is in the way the American healthcare system is set up. It's in procedures and in the case of the doctors and in certainly in prescribing the drugs as well.
Well, I know you guys want to be unleashed so you could go on and do this stuff about your solution. So why don't you go for it and tell us what you want to say.
We don't want to.
No. I'd like to.
No, this has been very enjoyable.
So. I'd like you to have the time.
You're really making a very important point here because the system is weighted, as Jim said, to procedures, and there is no. Nobody cares about preventing disease and conditions that could be prevented.
With diet and exercise changes, for instance.
That and just doing research on preventive areas. There's no money for it. It's all in the treatment. It's all in the procedures.
And so many people are getting ill from the treatments, too.
Exactly.
One drug leads to another thing, to another thing.
Absolutely, and this is why... We talk about the need for a true national system where you would have some way to monitor a lot of these drug interactions and you'd see exactly what's happening. Right now, so much of it is anecdotal. Nobody's really tracking it.
So talk to us about single payer, which we all want. Everyone that's listening, I think, wants that.
Well, one of the things that we concluded, we'll each share a little bit of this. One of the things we concluded when we looked at this whole issue, that the single payer system obviously makes the most sense. These multiple providers, among the problems with the huge number of plans we have out there and the great number of insurers, it has created this gigantic bureaucracy in the American healthcare system. You go into doctor's offices across America and you find, 20, 25% of the people in some cases processing the paper, trying to get referrals, trying to find out why the doctor's bill was reduced when they felt they properly billed and so forth. There are actually associations of people who have come together to try to get streamline the billing procedures for doctors. So there's this huge overlap, and there have been any number of studies on this that show as much as one out of three healthcare dollars in the U.S. are now going for administration, much higher than any other system. So you just look at this and you just see right away a single-payer system immediately would reduce a huge amount of that bureaucracy. You wouldn't have to have somebody in a doctor's office submitting forms to X number of different providers and having to know what one provided and what one the other didn't and trying to keep track of that enormous complexity. So that alone told us that this makes sense. And, of course, as you just alluded to, a number of people have looked at this issue over time and have reached a similar kind of conclusion. We also then tried to figure out, what would be the best way to bring this about. And we're in a kind of mood in this country that's very anti-government in every conceivable kind of way, and certainly government has let the country down in any number of ways. We kept trying to figure out how to administer this, and we came up with, we think, is a novel idea to do this.
We recognize that there is such an anti-government attitude in the country anymore that trying to do it through a government agency just wasn't going to fly. And so we suggested maybe the answer is to pattern it after a quasi-independent agency that some people would argue doesn't work. But for the most part, for the last century has, and that's the Federal Reserve Board.
So I just need to ask you something here. You're describing the Federal Reserve. I was coached by a political economist. Jeff Fawcett is one. So the Federal Reserve is bankers regulating bankers. And
right.
Alan Greenspan is not, you said it's less political. My God, Alan Greenspan is quite political, I think.
Well, one of the things you do have with the Fed system, though, is that the board as a whole is appointed over a series of different administrations. So you technically, no one Fed administration is subject to that kind of influence by the White House. Now, you can argue that maybe this hasn't always worked and so forth, but over time, I think most people generally feel the Fed has been reasonably independent of the politics of one year. You know, there are exceptions to that.
The other thing is, and we point out, this is just a, we toss this out as a starting point to talk about. I mean, we also make the point that membership in this board, unlike the Fed, which is right, bankers, would be divided among all representatives of the healthcare field, you know, doctors, nurses, hospital people, and the public at large, because there has got to be a countervailing force on there. And no single entity should be able to control it. And that's one of the things we think would mitigate against.
Well, you know, there's this term that you may have heard called regulatory capture, which is what we've seen with the FDA, where the bureaucracy that's supposed to be regulated
right.
by, gets captured by the industry.
Right. Oh,
so
sure.
How?
Sure.
I mean, I want so much to see single payer in this country, to see socialized medicine. I so much want this to happen, but I'm really concerned. The other thing is that you mentioned using a flat tax, and I have to comment that a flat tax is regressive. Poor people pay more when there's a flat tax.
No, I mean, we've written tax books over the years, and we're always opposed to them. But there are going to have to be compromises to get this through.
Mm-hmm.
And we're on record on the progressive income tax like nobody else is. But the Medicare, we've also structured this in such a way so that there is progressivity to it, because the flat tax would apply to all income, not just wages. So right off the top of the top of the income scale, those people at the very highest levels would be paying that tax on their stocks and bonds and capital gains and all of their income, which they do not pay now. Mm-hmm. So that's why we point out that for the average person, there'd probably be very little change in the tax bite from the Medicare bite. But for the wealthy people, there would be a substantial tax increase.
But we're going so far in the other direction from this right now in this country in every way, not just health care, but in every conceivable way, this country is going in the opposite direction.
You're
so,
right.
And, you know, I think most of us who are progressives feel like, okay, so if we go on to, well, we can try to do what they did in the Ukraine. Let's hit the streets and get shot with rubber bullets and get tear gas sprayed into our eyes. But what do you think is going to move this along? How is this going to?
It's going to have to come from the bottom up. It is not going to come from the top down for the foreseeable future, at least. Enough people are going to have to band together and demand that something be done. And you can actually see some movement here in different parts of the country now.
I think people also realize, even some folks in Congress who otherwise wouldn't do this, everybody seems to realize the market is failing here, that there's no catastrophic coverage, that there's this huge hole in the safety net on that issue alone. And you're even seeing comments out of folks who otherwise wouldn't make derogatory comments about the market system, that they realize something must be done. So we don't expect this to happen overnight. But there was a very interesting piece in the New York Times yesterday which said that health experts around the country seem to agree that really some kind of universal care is going to have to be enacted. They're arguing over what form it should take and how it should actually be structured. But the fact that statement was even made so flatly is a significant step forward, that people realize that something's going to have to be done on this before too long.
Well, I have to say that I'm glad that we still live in a country where this book could be published. And you could still be talking to me on the air about it.
Well,
I think at the point that stops, we're in trouble.
That's true.
Yeah.
This is true.
Yeah.
Well, it's had quite a reception, and which is certainly has been very uplifting to see. And it's been all over the country. We've heard from people just in about every section.
Well, I strongly urge my listeners to pick up the book and look at it. It's called Critical Condition, How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine. If you think you had any idea how bad it is, you don't have any idea. It's much worse than you think. Donald Bartlett and James Steele, thank you so much for your work. And thank you also for doing this show today.
Very nice to be with you, Lisa.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks very much. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman, and if you need more information or you want a cassette copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-8255. 2772. For a list of other available shows or information about guests, go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.com. Also, information on subscribing to the new newsletter, The Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness, 8.5 by 11 Productions,